Warning, the podcast Under the Stairs is not safe for work. We'll feature movie spoilers and language which most listeners may find offensive. Brought to you in conjunction with Legion Podcast Network. Welcome to the podcast Under the Stairs. Hi everyone and welcome to the podcast Under the Stairs. This is bonus episode number 35. I'm your host Duncan McLeish and welcome to the show. Bonus episode 35 sees a very special interview. This guy is incredible. His work output is nothing short of absolutely astounding, and I believe I own all his books, which makes me just a little bit of a fanboy for the interview that's coming up very shortly. I'm going to be interviewing none other than Troy Haworth. He is the author of such fantastic books as volumes 1 and 2 of So Deadly, So Perverse, the Giallo retrospective books, Splintered Visions, Lucio Fulci and his films, as well as The Haunted World of Mario Bava. Oof. Just a little bit of absolute awesomeness. He's kind of written the books for some of my favourite filmmakers of all time. So I was very excited, to say the least, to chat to him. And the interview coming up very shortly is incredible. Loved it. He stuck around for a good hour to chat about the work he's doing in his books, the upcoming volume 3 of So Deadly, So Perverse, as well as his commentary work that he's done for some fantastic Blu-ray releases. So yeah, that's all coming up very, very shortly. It seemed apt to get him on the show because we were going to be doing a little Baz v Giallo show, which will be dropping on Monday. And ahead of that, I know a lot of people that follow this podcast had put on the page that they weren't exactly familiar with Giallo, where to start, what to check out, etc. And Troy literally has written a book on it, so it kind of made sense to see if we could get him in to talk about the genre, his loves of the genre, and we even touch on some movies that you may have never heard of before, but Troy recommends them highly, so if you can get your hands on them, then you should. I just want to thank everyone for all the support over the last couple of weeks. The response to the In Reverence series has been nothing short of absolutely outstanding. You guys really seem to dig that, and I can't wait to bring you the second installment of that, which will arrive sometime mid-May. And I'm not releasing the film just yet, I like to keep you guys guessing, but the response has been absolutely phenomenal. Out with that, there's obviously a ton of content coming up over the next few weeks, so just please keep following, checking out the show, sharing it amongst your friends and doing all that funky jazz on Facebook. It really does help when you promote the show out there amongst your friends and bring them over into the group page to interact with you guys. And you know that I think you guys are absolutely awesome. So I've talked enough. You guys are checking out this interview show because you want to hear Troy. So it seems like the apt time to jump out. So you're going to hear promos for shows that I love. When I return, I'm joined by Troy Haworth. And this is a fantastic interview. Can't wait for you to hear it. And I will speak to you all on the other side.
Do you like movie reviews that are insightful, thought-provoking, and delivered by somebody who's trained to critically dissect every aspect of a motion picture without ever having to use obscenities?
Then you've got the wrong f***ing show. Kruger Nation Horror Podcast is ready to feed your slasher movie and exploitation needs. There'll be more blood, expletives, and titties than you can shake your grandma's beetle flaps at. Visit www.krugernation.com.
Hello and welcome to Hello, This is the Doom Show. I'm Richard.
And I hate the burning.
Shh, who are you? Speak.
And I'm Brad.
She came in and said, bark, bark, bark. And he said, bark, bark, bark. And she said, bark, 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 bark. That's what I got.
One is the Suspiria boner. The other is the Inferno boner.
Which one is crying?
The boner of tears.
Hello, This Is the Doomed Show is available on hellodoomedshow.podomatic.com and doomedmoviethon.com.
Hello, hello, this is the Doomed Show, Richard, Brad, Jeffrey, Naffa.
It's the Doomed Show.
Hello,
hello,
this is the Doomed Show, slashers, G.I. Low and horror.
And welcome back. So it is my immense pleasure at this time to be joined by a very hard-working individual in between publishing many, many, many books on Italian horror cinema and exploitation cinema in general, as well as covering and two hugely detailed books and an upcoming third book on the giallo subgenre in itself, and also contributing more recently in these announcements to some commentary work on upcoming releases, the likes of Arrow Video's Bird in the Crystal Plumage, if I'm correct with that one. It is my pleasure to introduce Troy Holworth to the podcast Under the Stairs. How are you doing, sir?
Well, I'm good. I don't know if I can live up to that introduction, though.
I think you can. You genuinely, it is scary how many books I actually own by you. I was looking at this earlier on. I didn't realise I'd pretty much got the whole collection. I'm currently working my way through. I tend to bulk buy things and then try and find time to get through them. And I'm currently working through your Splintered Visions Lucio Fulci book at the moment. And what I love about it is the fact that you don't just instantly go for the standard Fulci titles. Rather, you kind of encompass his career as a director, which a lot of people don't realise happened a lot earlier than when they think it did, and ran for a bit longer than they think it did as well. A lot of people just think he had a couple of movies out in the 70s, some out in the 80s, kind of disappeared after that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that was, basically that was really my kind of mission statement in a way. I really wanted to get away from the notion of him just being this gore meister. Mm-hmm. At one point, I even thought about calling it something along the lines of, more than gore. a little too punny, perhaps. But I wanted to focus on the fact that this was a very diverse talent, a man who had started off making musicals and comedies, and then gradually through the years started getting into darker subject matter. He was not a one-trick pony by any means. He was an incredibly diverse talent. And I think for a man who worked in a variety of different genres, I think he basically did very, very good work in almost all of them. I mean, he made some outstanding spaghetti westerns, for example, some great gialli, and obviously the horror films, but also some very amusing comedies and action movies. He did a very good Polizia Tesco film called Contraband. Mm-hmm. So this is a very, very fine erotic movie called The Devil's Honey. So obviously this was somebody who could do films in a wide variety of different genres and styles.
It's a really interesting time in cinema just in general, that Italian structure of just directors who, like, nowadays we see directors get very comfortable within one genre. They like to kind of stake their claim there, and they very seldom move out with for fear of being, judged more critically doing something which they are not known for. But that period in Italian cinema, it was very much you're a working director, and as and when projects come, yes, there are certain ones that you will guide and steer, but there's other ones you'll just be hired to do and you just get on with the job. And Fulci very much encompasses that idea of the working director, very much kind of taking on that scope from such directors as Bava as well, who I know that you, I actually have I read the Bava book that you wrote last year. It's incredible work, and he's another guy who had this huge career that many people just don't know the extent or the scope of what that guy was actually doing, involved with, where he came from. In terms of your process, how did you, like, obviously you're an American, and I'm a European, so the growing up, the interest of European horror cinema, we get a lot of American movies over here. Like, it shapes quite a lot of what we do. But I was very much aware growing up that I had access to everything from Hammer horror to German horror to Italian horror. How did you stumble across this particular region of work? And, I mean, when did you realise in your process of watching this that this was something you were passionate about writing?
Well, it all started really probably much earlier in my life than it probably should have done. I was a one of those kids who was not forbidden to watch these movies. I was actually fortunate enough to have parents who understood that this is all just sort of fantasy and make-believe, so there's no harm in it. My mom was a big influence in that sense, in particular, because she was a big fan of horror films. She loved Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing and Vincent Price and all these people. So I grew up watching these movies, and I can assure you I was probably the only kid in grade school who knew who these people were. I mean, even extending out to, you know, Lionel Atwill and Basil Rathbone and people like that. I'm sure that I was the only kid at school who thought, God, I'd like to be like Basil Rathbone when I grow up. I mean, that's just not... This, you know, everybody was sort of focusing on Schwarzenegger and Stallone, but those guys were who I thought were cool, so that tells you something about me. When I was a little kid growing up in the 80s, I was born in 77, and... as a kid, watching, sometimes seeing them on TV, sometimes watching them because they had been recorded the night before, there were some European horror films, and I, when I say the term European horror film, that does encompass obviously Hammer, but I tend to use it really more thinking more along the lines of continental horror of Italy and France and Spain and so forth. And they did, obviously, they ran a ton of Hammer movies when I was growing up. I became familiar with them very early on. But every now and again, there would be these little weird films that would show up on TV that I, you know, as a very young kid, I could get a sense that there was something a little bit different about them. And so there'd be films that would show up like The Night Evelyn Came Out of the Grave, or Baron Blood, or The Black Cat, the Lucio Fulci Black Cat. And, you know, I was too young at that point to understand where these films came from and the fact that they were dubbed and the fact that they were done in a kind of different way from what I was used to. But I could tell there was something different about them, and they kind of stood out for me on that level. Really, I think the movie that kind of triggered it all for me was Baron Blood. It was a movie that showed on late night TV, and my mom had recorded it. And when I watched it, there was just something about it that was so wonderfully creepy and atmospheric, that was so different from even a typical Hammer movie of the same period. It just had a different kind of vibe to it. And Baron Blood is by no means one of Mario Bava's better films, but I do like it. I think it's very entertaining. In a way, it feels almost like if Mario Bava had gone to England to make a Hammer film, that's kind of what you would have gotten. It has that kind of more cookie cutter plot to it. Not to suggest that the Hammer films were necessarily like that, but the Hammer films tended to be a little bit more, in their own way, they were more rational. They were more plot driven, whereas the Italian films tend to be a little bit more atmosphere and kind of delirium based. So Baron Blood doesn't really show Bava at, you know, full speed, so to speak, but I guess as a primer, it did really well for me. And it made such a huge impression on me that, you know, I started seeking out other films. When I got to a point a little bit later on that I understood that it was directed by a man who made quite a few horror films, I started seeking out other movies of his. And I just gradually over time, reading a lot about the genre, and again, at a very young age, reading things like the Encyclopedia of Horror Films, the Phil Hardy book, which... I'm quite sure there was a lot in that book that I didn't quite understand when I was 8, 9, 10 years old, but it gave me a sense of what reviews should be like, that it was more than just saying, oh, this is good or this is bad, or, you know, the typical it sucks or it's awesome kind of thing that you see all the time. It has a little bit of depth to it. So that made a huge impression on me. And just over time, I discovered I really liked writing about these films. And just to make a long story short, when I was in college, I decided I was going to write an article on Mario Bava, and the article kind of swelled out a bit, and I thought, well, maybe I'll make it a monograph. And I had a professor at the college that I was going to, and I showed him what I had written, and he said, you've got a book here, mm-hmm. which seemed extraordinary to me. I mean, I never thought of myself as writing books. So with his kind of encouragement and blessing, I worked at it harder and harder, and eventually it came out. It originally came out through FAB Press in England in 2002. And then when it sold very well, it won some prizes, it got very nice reviews, and then when the rights lapsed to it 10 years later, I decided to go ahead and revise it because I had sort of changed my attitude about certain films, and you know, as you do over time, opinions change. And so I decided to go back and redo it, and I hooked up with another company. This one based out of the U.S. called Midnight Marquee Press. And since that time, I just pretty much have been writing and writing and writing.
How long does it take in terms of, I mean, the specific subgenres you're looking at, or the directors that you're looking at, have very storied, very large back catalogues of movies, and not all of them will be readily available. A lot of these movies may have played, especially in the States, maybe played like a drive-through for like a year or two and disappear. How long does it take from the process of, I'm going to write a book, for example, about Fulci, to being able to track down the movies you're going to be able to review in that book, to actually creating the book and taking it? Are we talking like half a year, several years?
It would depend on the topic, but I can say that I'm very fortunate now that these days so much, everything is virtually available pretty readily. I mean, if I were trying to write some of these books, 15, 20 years ago, forget it. It would have taken a lot longer. It would have been a lot more difficult. Nowadays, even movies that never got released in English, many of them, if not all of them, are available online, usually with fan-made subtitles even. So you don't have to just sit there and try to guess at what you're watching. I mean, yeah. I remember when I first saw Vampiros Lesbos, the Jess Franco movie, I saw it in German without any subtitles. And I mean, not that it really mattered, because it didn't necessarily make much more sense with subtitles than without. But that's part of that movie's charm, anyway. But I'd say, on average, a typical project, and bearing in mind that I tend to work very quickly, which I don't know if that's good or bad. It's just the way that I work. I'd say, on average, you're looking at anywhere from a year to a year and a half, depending on how involved a project is.
Mm-hmm. I remember picking up So Deadly, So Perverse, Volume 1, and, very much counting down, till Volume 2 dropped, which you didn't leave me waiting around that long, and always wondered if there would be a Volume 3. And one of the reasons I contacted you to get you on to do this is that I was not aware that you were working on Volume 3 with the speed which you have been, and you've been posting some announcements about that. And for those that have been following those series of books, Volume 2 pretty much brought us up to date with what would be kind of categorised as, Giallo or Gialli. But Book 3 is going in a slightly different direction, and I think to some extent a far more interesting direction, which is you're really going to be extending it out past Italy to look at movies that were, I would imagine, indirectly but more directly influenced by the work. Can you talk to us a little bit about Volume 3?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I should say that when I set out to do this book back in 2013, I only saw it as a book. Mm-hmm. I didn't see it as a series. And it's just the way it worked out that it got to be so big. And because it's through Midnight Marquee Press, who uses what is known as a print-on-demand platform of printing, which is to say they don't they don't have a surplus of stock. They, you know, if something is ordered, it's printed on demand, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
There are limitations with that and limitations with space with regards especially to color images and so forth. And I knew that books like this and the Bava book and the Fulci book, it was important to have as many colorful images in it as you could, because these movies are very visual. And if you want to try to convey that aspect, it's hard to do that with just a handful of black and white pictures. So I knew I wanted there to be a nice amount of the very wonderful poster art and stills and so forth. So I just realized after a certain point that that the manuscript I'd written was much too big to be just one book.
Mm-hmm.
So it had to be split in two. And so volume one, it's funny how it worked out, but it's indicative of how the cycle worked out in terms of how the movies were made. The first volume only covers the first 10 years, whereas the second volume covers 40 years. And I think that's very strange, but it just points to the fact that those first 10 years were when the most amount of activity was being done. That was when those movies were really being cranked out a lot. In a typical Italian theater back in those days, you could walk, you know, and see a ton of gialli being played at a single given time. So that wasn't always the case. And obviously, as you got into the 80s and the Italian film industry kind of started to collapse, there's far less of them. So, yes, it ended up being split into two. And I really thought that was going to be the end of it. But then I would get occasional messages from people saying, you know, why don't you do a follow-up volume that talks about the non-Italian movies? And the more I heard from people, the more I realized, well, first of all, realized that there's interest in a third volume, which is always nice to know.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to that, I thought, well, yeah, there is something to be said for the influence that this genre had. And we don't tend to think of the giallo and the slasher movie as being kind of synonymous in many respects, and yet in the way they were, the giallo kind of arose out of, in a sense, it all kind of started with film noir, and then through the German creamy films of the 50s and 60s, then you had the giallo films, and the giallo films in turn kind of bred the slasher movies. And you can see that with movies like Bava's Twitch of the Death Nerve or Sergio Martino's Torso, which are basically slasher movies, or Michele Soavi's Stage Fright, which is basically a giallo slasher hybrid. So there's a lot of ground to cover, and I knew when I was doing this third volume that there was absolutely no way that I could make it quote-unquote definitive for a variety of reasons. First of all, it's a slippery slope trying to argue that certain films are really directly linked to the giallo. It's pretty much a judgment call. So there's a lot of movies where people might say, well, I agree or I disagree with this one, which is fine. But also there are so many of them that I would once again be ending up with a multi-volume thing. So I didn't want to do that. So I started out with a list of titles and gradually fined it down by watching them and saying, well, I don't really think there's much I can say about this one, or this one doesn't really have enough elements to justify its inclusion. But I'm really coming in on the final stretch right now. I'm into just the last handful of titles. So I should be finished with this one very, very shortly. And then after that, it's just a matter of doing the final editing and proofing and then getting it turned into the publisher. So hopefully it'll be out this year.
Oh, fantastic. I'm very curious to see what makes the book. It's one of these things, as a big fan of that particular subgenre of cinema, I tend to find myself finding elements in other movies where there's a clear linkage, you know, whether it's not the director has explicitly or implicitly said, you know, that they grew up watching these movies, or, you know, particular scenes in certain movies influence their work, or whether it's I start to put them in myself.
You start to see it in everything, yeah.
Yeah, it's really weird. I always contended that there's a kind of lesser known, well, it gets lumped in as a slasher movie. I don't necessarily think it fairly suits the the slasher movie, but Donald Kamel's White of the Eye.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
To me is, you know, it's so very much nearer yeah. to the Jolly than it would be to a slasher, but, you know, just gets, for ease, it is very easily lumped in that slasher term when it comes to how it is perceived by fans, or even how it was marketed recently. I know that Arrow put it out a few years ago, yeah. and Scream Factory put it out in the States, I think it was just over a year ago, and both companies leaned more on the this is a slasher movie than a giallo movie, and when you look at it, there's definitely elements in there. It's a surprising what you obviously mentioned about that short period of time, those 10 years where there were so many movies came out, and how it that is almost like a proto template for slasher genre as well, which went through a very similar period of you know, turnover of maybe about 5-6 years of very yeah. fruitful, intense releases, and then they fade away, and then they make a resurgence, and Jolly as a genre has become very much in vogue over the last 3 or 4 years. I don't know if you've yes. noticed as well, but there's a lot of people now citing influence or trying to capture the vibe and spirit. What is it, do you think, about that subgenre that is still as interesting over some of the other subgenres in cinema that have come and gone? You know, their heyday has long since gone. What is it you think about that particular subgenre that still fascinates and inspires filmmakers to this day?
Well, they're very, at their best, I should say, at their best, they're incredibly stylish movies. They have a unique kind of atmosphere and feel to them. They're mystery films, but they're mystery films where rationality doesn't really enter into the picture. I always tell people that, you know, when they're starting out to watch, like, Dario Argento movies, for example, don't expect everything to add up and make sense. Because if you do, you really are missing the point, and you're just going to get irritated with it. Mm-hmm. And I've had this happen with people where I've shown them, you know, something like Deep Red or Tenebrae or whatever, both fantastic films, but there are aspects of those films that sometimes will bug people and say, well, what was the point of that? Well, there is no point sometimes. It's just there because it can be done. I mean, sometimes, you know, it's like that point of view shot, the Lumicrane shot in Tenebrae.
Oh, yeah.
There's no logical reason for that to be there. It cannot possibly be anybody's point of view. Mm. It's just there because it would be a cool shot, and I'm glad that it's there. There's a scene in Deep Red where the Professor Giordani character is... in his study, and he realizes that the killer is taunting him, and all of a sudden this animatronic doll comes into the room. How the hell does that work? How does it? I mean, it's not on a wire. It's not obviously physically moving on its. How does that work? Frankly, I don't care. It's just really creepy and really cool. That's what these movies do. They kind of pay lip service to the rational aspect, but at the same time they basically undermine that by saying, wow, the logic doesn't really matter. So they're pure cinema, and they also have they just encompass so much of what was at one time a very different attitude in filmmaking, which wasn't as concerned with being politically correct, which wasn't concerned with being tasteful. A lot of these films, by nature, I mean, giallo basically are lurid films. So there's a strong sense of eroticism in them. There's a strong sense of sleaze in them. As a matter of fact, there was even kind of a brief window of time where there were kind of porno giallo films made as well. movies that literally had, you know, penetration of various different kinds. and They have an attitude, and they are emblematic of a particular period of time where I think audiences or filmmakers rather weren't as constrained by some of the expectations that are imposed on them nowadays. I do talk about these kind of giallo pastiche and homage movies like Amer and The Strange Color of Your Body's Tears and movies like that in this book as well. These are different, though, in the sense that, as opposed to something like Brian De Palma, for example, who has always steadfastly denied that he's really familiar with these films. And frankly, based on the comments he's made, I'm inclined to sort of believe him.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a certain amount of coincidence. And also, to be fair, a certain amount of cross-pollination going on. I think that people tend to think that De Palma rips off Dario Argento a lot, but I'm more inclined to think that Dario Argento in Tenebrae is kind of doing a De Palma-style movie in a sense.
Yeah.
It feels to me, it's a lot sexier than his usual film. So it feels like, you know, it was inspired a little bit more by Dress to Kill, for mm-hmm. example, as opposed to these usual styles. So it's not always a matter of the big American filmmaker ripping off the European counterpart. It does cut both ways. You mentioned Donald Camel as well. I highly doubt that Donald Camel was sitting down and watching movies like Strip Nude for Your Killer or Play Motel and things like that. So probably is a coincidence, but that emphasis on kind of designer murder set pieces
mm-hmm.
and sort of twisted psychopathology does link it in, so it fits as well. The enduring fascination is, I guess, that they just are unique films unto themselves, and I think the more that people try to openly recreate them and pay homage to them just shows up how wonderfully, effortlessly weird they really were.
Yeah, I think one of the surprising things for me on the show that I do, we review movies weekly and we try and expand out to all the subgenres, all the decades, all the eras of horror, and we mix and match. We do a subset of shows where a very good friend of mine who basically grew up in a household where, unlike my household and what sounds like your household, horror was very much banned. And he's a little bit older than me, and he grew up when he was in his formative years of when he would have consumed horror. The Video Nasty scandal was pretty prevalent in the UK, and it did very much shape how his parents allowed him to consume movies. And as a result, what we've been doing over the last couple of years is working through horror movies which he's never seen. I mean, we're talking about a man who's in his early 40s who's never seen Psycho, who's never seen the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You know, these like prominent movies within the genre that he's never experienced. And what we've been doing more recently is tackling subgenres and getting them to sit down and experience them. And we've just actually recorded, it comes out a couple of days after this episode will drop, we did one on Jally. Now, he knows that it's a particular favourite of mine. He doesn't particularly like older movies. He doesn't really like movies with bad dubbing. And as a result of that, the show went very interesting, very quick. The three movies I chose for him were Blood and Black Lace, Mario Bava, Torso by Sergio Martino, and Tenebrae by Dario Argento. And it's interesting seeing his reactions to certain things and how he has linked it to movies he's seen more recently as well. What I was going to say is that the thing that came out quite interesting from that is that there are certain movies, because it's such a fruitful period in movie making history, there are so many movies that get so much attention lavished on them. Argento movies by almost default from that time period are highlighted as must see movies. Certain directors, the likes of Martino or Bava, or you know, even kind of moving out with into people like Fulci, are kind of heralded as, even though the movies might not necessarily all the back catalogue be of the highest quality, these are the names that people will instinctively go for because they're names that are known. If you could name a few Giallo movies that you think are criminally underseen and should be seen, what would they be and why would you recommend them?
Well, I have quite a few that I could think of. One that comes to mind right away is actually a film that Fulci co-wrote, and it was directed by Riccardo Freda, who is a fairly well-known sort of cult Italian director, although a lot of his films are not readily available. It was from 1969. It starred Klaus Kinski. It's called Double Face. And that is one of those kind of late 60s, early 70s kind of sexy giallo movies where it's a little bit more of an emphasis on sort of psychological head games as opposed to body count type scenario.
Mm-hmm.
It's an extremely good film. It really features, I think, one of Kinski's best performances. He and Freda did not get along, which is no surprise. Neither Kinski nor Freda really seem to get along with hardly anybody, so why should they get along with each other? Nevertheless, Kinski's work on screen is top-notch in it. It has a phenomenal soundtrack by Nora Orlandi, who is one of the great unheralded kind of composers of European cult cinema. I mean, we tend to talk a lot for good reason about people like Ennio Morricone and Stelvio Cipriani, but Nora Orlandi's work was quite good, and her score for Double Face is one of my favorites. So that's a great film that I have been after Arrow to look into, and I don't know what the right situation is, but hopefully, if not them, somebody can pick that movie up and put it out. It's a great film. There is a late 60s Cesare Canavari film called Hyena in the Safe, which very few people have heard of and very few people have seen. And Cesare Canavari, by no means a great director, he ended up doing a lot of those kind of really sleazy Nazi exploitation movies, but that's a really neat sort of pop art, late 60s giallo suspense movie. And it's one of those movies that I watched, and I went into it knowing nothing about it, and had never really read much about it, and I just smiled the whole way through, because it was just so, it was sort of light and airy, and it was fun. It was just one of those movies that I really would recommend if you can ever get a hold of a copy with subtitles. God, there are so many that come to mind. Paolo Cavara directed a couple of, I think, excellent giallo films. There's The Black Belly of the Tarantula, which is fairly well known, and I think one of the best sort of overt Argento imitation movies. I mean, right down to the title, it has that kind of, you know, the animal theme that was very animal or insect theme that was very prominent in the 70s, thanks to Bird with the Crystal Plumage. But he also did one from the late 70s called Plot of Fear, and that's a really, really offbeat movie that I think doesn't tend to get the attention it deserves. It has a really eclectic cast, including Eli Wallach and Tom Skerritt, in a part that's so small and so minor that it makes you wonder why he's even there. It's still a good movie, and it's kind of twisted and kinky and strange, and I think it was the Raro label that put that out on video, so that's available. I highly recommend it. Mm-hmm. Massimo D'Alemano is another director that I like very much, who doesn't tend to get his due. What Have You Done to Solange? What Have They Done to Your Daughters? Both excellent films. Also, his first giallo, a late 60s film called A Black Veil for Lisa, which unfortunately is only available available in English in a highly edited version that was also rescored by the American distributor. The Italian version is much better, but where else are you going to see a giallo starring Sir John Mills? So that's out. There are so many. Some of the ones that I'm watching now, or have been watching now, from other countries. I mean, it's no big surprise that Spain was particularly prolific with giallo films in the 70s, mm-hmm. Because Spain was obviously involved in financing a lot of the Italian films. So you had some of the Paul Naschy films, for example, that really were overt giallo homages. Dragonfly for Each Corpse, for example, or Blue Eyes at a Broken Doll. But, you know, again, every now and again you stumble across this little offbeat gem that you watch, and you think, boy, I've never even heard of this one before. And there was a film from, I think it was from 1976, called The Heat of the Flame, which in all the years I've been reading about these films, I have never heard of it before. And it's kind of, I can understand why it has some problematic aspects that I discuss in the book. I don't want to give too much away about it, but basically it does involve some kinky sexual aspects that probably would be troubling for a lot of viewers. But it's a really well-made and interesting little movie. And I could go on and on, but I mean, the reason that we talk as much as we do about people like Argento and Bava and Fulci is the same reason why, when it comes to spaghetti westerns, we always talk about Sergio Leone. They're the best. I mean, they were consistently the ones who had the biggest impact and the ones who did the best quality of work. Argento had a magnificent run from the 70s, I'd say through the 90s.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
I have not been impressed with his 21st century work for the most part.
I've got a soft spot for Sleepless. I do think Sleepless is a legitimate attempt to try and do something. Try and do something a bit more in an older school vein for him. I don't necessarily think it's a flawless movie, but he has certainly had issues since. And the more recent news of him being involved with two projects that he's trying to get off the ground just now. I'd be happy if he just focused on one. I don't know if they...
Well, I'd be happy if he made something that he really seemed to be excited, truly invested in about doing.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I'm sure there are a lot of reasons for this. I mean, it's fairly well known that Argento had had a lot of drug issues for a long time. And, sometimes that will rot your brain after a certain point. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's hard to keep up with things when you get older as well. He had his big success when he was a young man, and perhaps now he's just at a point where he's doing what he thinks the kids today want to see.
Yeah.
And so his movies now have a sleazier kind of quality to them. There's more of a grindhouse quality to them. Mm-hmm. They're not as elegant as they used to be. I'm sure there are a lot of other factors that come into it too. His father was a big influence on his career for many years, and I think his father really gave him the support that he needed to do a lot of his best films. His father died around the time he was making opera, so then he went over to America and tried to make movies here, and that didn't go very well. Came back to Italy, still had a kind of a good business base to work from, and made a couple films in the 90s with adequate resources, but then after that it was like, all the money's gone, and I don't know if his heart's really in it anymore. Mm-hmm. Or if he really, if he really cares about what he's doing. But through the 90s, and I'd say The Stendhal Syndrome for me is his last truly great movie. I really love that movie, but up through that time, he really, even his weaker films are still highly interesting, and you can tell that they're the work of a real artist. Nowadays, if the average person were to sit down and watch something like Dracula 3D, for example, they would say, this guy's a great director? Well, I'd have a hard time arguing at that point. Although there are moments of the old magic in that film. They're fleeting, but they're there. There are a couple of scenes where I'm like, okay, yeah, maybe it's going to... No, it's still terrible. It's not coming together. But... it doesn't matter. He can make Dracula 3D for the rest of his life, and it's not going to take away what he did for so many years. But the point is, we talk about these guys as much as we do because they're just the best of the best, and they had the biggest impact, and they've earned our respect. I mean, don't forget Fulci also. His final years were unfortunate, although I think in his case, it was more a matter of failing health and lack of resources. I think he still was trying to make a good movie. Mm-hmm. He just wasn't always able to pull it off because the money and the time wasn't there. His energy just wasn't there because he was so sick. Bava didn't really have that problem. He continued doing great work throughout, but he died rather young. So who knows if he had lived into his 70s and 80s, what his later films might have been like.
Mm-hmm. We obviously were touching on Argento, in particular his early body of work over the first couple of decades, and the movie that really kicks all off, the movie that really kind of like sets the stage for what's to come is The Bird with the Crystal Plumage, and we would be remiss if we did not delve into your involvement with the upcoming Arrow 4K restoration release of that. What can you tell us of that? I mean, at the moment we know that it's a commentary, so I take it it's a movie commentary. And how did that come about?
God, I don't know. So much of it just seems to be luck. I don't know. I was not initially involved. I was not the person that was... I don't know how much of this I'm really supposed to get into. I won't mention names, but there was somebody else was supposed to do it. Mm-hmm. And they were unable to for whatever reason. So I got a message asking, would you be interested in doing it? And I said, yes, of course. So it came together fairly quickly for me, pretty much in at the 11th hour. But that's one of those movies I know so well. Yeah. I've seen it so many times down through the years. I can recite huge, quotations from it, so it was not a hard film for me to do a commentary for. It's one of the real kind of cornerstone films of the genre. Yeah. I mean, it was not by any means the first giallo. There's kind of a misconception that Argento kind of created this genre, but that's absolutely not true. Mm-hmm. Bava got there first, and even Fulci made his first giallo films before Argento did, so... but it was the movie that connected with the public and made it popular, immensely popular for a long time. And it can be argued that Argento has spent the rest of his career pretty much remaking it.
Yeah.
A variation on a theme, pretty much. The Arrow release, we should mention that Arrow used to be pretty much run by different people. And I think that the people that used to be involved weren't as concerned about quality as they are now. Mm-hmm. And so they had done a release back a number of years back that was not very good. And unfortunately, it also had a very strange transfer that was supervised by the cinematographer, Vittorio Storaro. And I talk about this in the commentary, that Storaro developed this peculiar idea of a kind of universal aspect ratio that he thought could be imposed on movies that he had shot in the 235 widescreen process. And it was called the Universum format, if I remember correct. And it was a 2-to-1 ratio, which meant that a good bit of information was being cut off the sides. But he was basically reframing it himself, shot by shot, and it looked awful. I mean, it just looked absolutely ridiculous. It's like, going back and drawing a mustache on one of your masterpieces. So fortunately now they've been able to do a brand new master of it, and they have some great new extras for it, and I'm not including my commentary in that. That's for other people to say if it's good or not. But I had a lot of fun talking about it, and obviously it's one of the key movies in the genre, so to get a chance to do a commentary on it was particularly welcome.
And is it something, I believe I saw you post, and I know that certain, at this stage with certain projects, having chatted to the Arrow guys before and interviewed them, there are certain things they can say and certain things they can't say. I do believe I read that you posted that you have upcoming commentary work as well. Is there any of them you can give details on, or are they all mums of work at the moment?
Yeah, I can talk about some of them. Some of them have to be announced yet, so I can't get into those. But my announcement of my involvement, I should say, in the Arrow release of Phenomena has been announced. So that's another Argento film I had an opportunity to talk about. I did a commentary for a Spanish giallo called Night of the Scorpion for a company called Dorado Films. Let me see. What else is coming up? Well, Arrow, I also did Kaltiki, the Immortal Monster, which is a Mario Bava, Ricardo Freda sort of sci-fi horror film from the late 50s. I did a commentary for that. That's also, I think it's already come out, so...
Yeah, I think it came out this week, and if it's not this week, it's next week, so it's pretty much there now.
Yeah, it should be out, and, I'm looking forward to getting my own copy soon so I can look at it, because that's never had a really good release before, so I'm excited about that. Trying to remember, I mean, obviously there are other ones in the past that I've done that are available. I did for Kino Video in the US, I did Hammer film called The Man Who Could Cheat Death. I did a Orson Welles, Tyrone Power sort of swashbuckler type movie called The Prince of Foxes. It's a little bit different, but still, my interests go beyond just horror, so that was an opportunity to talk about something different. And previously for Arrow, I did a commentary on The Night Evelyn Came Out of the Grave. Very quirky giallo from the early 70s. I'm sure I'm forgetting some things, but I did not a full-length commentary, but I did an audio essay for the Bloodstained Butterfly, a very, very good Duccio Tessari giallo from 1972, I believe.
Yeah, I love that movie.
Oh, it's a wonderful movie, and I'm very fond of that. I also did, for a German release of What Have They Done to Solange, I did a commentary on that. Obviously, the Arrow version is available, and many people already own it, but anybody who's looking to listen to me talk about the film in English on a German release, they can pick up that version as well.
Fantastic, fantastic. So, I mean, like you're... headlong into getting this next book out, but I imagine with your work ethic, you'll have already kind of got your sights on something else. Is, in terms of your writing, are there more stories to be told in Italian cinema that you would like to tell? You know, more careers you would like to chart down, or have your eyes decided to wander elsewhere? And if so, what's the dream next project for you to do when So Deadly, So Perverse Volume 3 comes out?
Well, let's see. There's a variety of different directions I can go with that. well, let's first of all, as of right now, as I said, I'm finishing up So Deadly Volume 3, and that will be the end of that particular series. I've also, in the meantime, done a book on Klaus Kinski called Real Depravities, the films of Klaus Kinski, and the black and white standard version of that book is already available.
Oh, fantastic.
However, they are also going to put out for the real Kinski fanatics, the ones who have a true devotion to our man Klaus and deep pockets. There's going to be a two-volume special edition with full color and a lot of exclusive picture content. So I'm going to be working on doing the captioning for all of the images for that, which is a ton of fun, let me tell you.
Mm-hmm.
So that I'll be working on once I finish So Deadly, So Perverse Volume 3. I have three commentaries to prepare for that... they all have to be done within, you know, a relatively short period of time. I can't tell you the titles yet, but the news will be out there eventually. I'm sure some of them will be of interest to your listeners, though, when the time comes.
Mm-hmm.
But my next book project is going to be on Paul Naschy, the Spanish sort of horror king. I decided to go ahead and do a book on his films. So that's going to be my next big project, and I also have another project in the works with a co-writer. It's going to be on the American TV series Columbo.
Ah, fantastic.
I'm very fond of that show, and the guy that I'm going to write it with basically came to me and asked if I'd like to go in on it with him, and so I said yes. So all the pressure won't be on me with that one, and I can kind of have a little bit more fun with it, perhaps. So after that, I don't know. I had thought of doing a encyclopedia of Italian horror films, and I prematurely said that I was going to do it, and only then to be told that I had a couple other people were working on something very similar, and I thought, there's no point in my doing it then. But that's okay. I mean, there are other genres within Italian cinema that I would have liked to have covered, but they've been covered so well.
Mm-hmm.
The Poliziotesco films, for example, I mean, I could not equal, let alone surpass, what Roberto Curti did with his book about Italian police films. So I'm not going to bother with that. You know, at one point I kind of toyed with the idea of maybe doing something about Jess Franco. You know, you've got Stephen Thrower's book coming out, the second volume of it coming out. Alain Petit came out with a book in France, and there's a couple of other books, I believe, in the works as well. So there again, you know, why bother? There's only so much interest, you know, to justify so many books. If the market weren't so flooded with books on Hammer films, I would love to do something about Hammer, but I just feel like that topic has been done to death. So
yeah,
it's difficult. I mean, to do something different, I did a book about an actor, Klaus Kinski. I think about other actors that I love. Christopher Lee is my favorite actor, but I could not do better than what Jonathan Rigby did with his book on Lee. So you do sometimes kind of look at it and say, well, I mean, if I feel like I can do something that's a little bit fresh and a little bit different, then go for it. But if not, you know, the need has already been satiated by something else that's good. So there's no point getting into it. So I have kind of hit a little bit of a wall in a sense that once these projects are done, I'm not looking to do anything immediately after that. There is the ongoing Tome of Terror series, which I write in collaboration with Chris Workman. That's an encyclopedia of horror film series. Mm-hmm. We've done the 1895 to 1929 volume. We've done the 30s volume. They're both available. I've written my half of the 40s volume, and that's going to be coming out. I don't know if it'll be this year or next year. So then after that, we'll be working on the 50s and so forth. So at least that'll keep me busy.
Last question I need to ask you before you go. You obviously spend so much time looking at historical horror movies and particular time periods. Do you get much of a chance to watch modern horror movies? And if so, are there exploitation movies? Are there any particular directors or movies that you've seen over the last wee while that you've thought, you know, this is really interesting, or any directions that you see within the genre at the moment that have piqued your interest?
Yeah, I think there continues to be good films that come out. I'm not as well versed with some of the directors' names, unfortunately. I only have so much room in my head and seems to be occupied with obscure Italian character actors. So, I can tell you, for example, I loved The Babadook.
Yeah.
I thought that was fantastic. It was a woman who directed that, and she's obviously very talented, and I'd like to see what she does next. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the guy's name, but he directed You're Next.
Adam Wingard.
Adam Wingard.
Yeah.
I thought those were very good, especially You're Next. I really liked that. I thought that was just a nasty and surprising little movie. There was a film, I think it was from last year, The Green Room.
Oh, yes. Yeah, The Green Room's excellent.
I like that. I principally watched it because I was curious to see Patrick Stewart in something like that, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah.
As I thought it was very good. I thought The Witch was excellent. Mm-hmm. Again, I can't remember the director's name.
Eggers directed that. That was his first movie as well, which is...
Is it his first? Well, yeah. There you go. He's obviously talented. I like that. I know anytime something comes out and it gets a bit of praise, you're always going to have the opposite side come out and say, oh, it's so overrated. And you know, fair enough. I mean, if you like it or don't like it, but I thought it was great. It really, I thought it had a tremendous sense of atmosphere. Those ones really leap to mind as far as horror films that I've seen more recently that I thought were quite good. I don't think the genre is dead. I think that there's always going to be probably more garbage than the good, but I think that's probably always been the case. We just tend to be a little bit nostalgic about the old days, I think. But as long as movies like this crop up, and I'm sure there's some other ones I'm forgetting, but as long as movies like this crop up, that's encouraging. I have not had a chance to watch The Neon Demon yet.
Oh, yeah. That was my favorite movie last year, actually. I thought it was phenomenal.
I've heard good things about that. I liked Refn's previous couple films that I saw, Drive and Only God Forgives. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say they're movies that I would watch over and over again, but I thought they were interesting, so I'm curious to see what this one is like. And apparently he's going to produce a remake of what have you done to Solange?
I did not know that. That's quite interesting.
I heard this. I don't know if it's going to happen or not. I don't know what I think of that. I don't know if you could do that story now. I mean, censorship has gone in a different direction, and I think in a weird way we're more conservative now than we used to be, so yeah. I don't know if you could do that now. And of course, inevitably, there's the Suspiria remake coming, but everything I'm hearing about that just makes me think I'll pass on it, but... You never know. You never know. I try not to trash things I haven't seen. I think it's not fair to do that, but nothing I've heard about that really sounds terribly appetizing. I mean, it's not, let's be honest, it's not a story for the ages, is it? It's not a story that needs to be told again and again. It's an audiovisual experience.
Yeah.
And this director has already said that, well, we're not using the garish colors and we're not using that type of music. It's like, well, what's the point?
Yeah.
But by the same token, if you are just going to go ahead and copy it, what's the point there either? So I guess, you know, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't.
Yeah, it's Catch 22. Have you ever checked out, you will have, no doubt you will have, and I know that you were saying you're a bit iffy with names, but Peter Strickland is a really interesting director from the UK. He's not done many movies, but he did one a couple of years ago called Barbarian Sim Studio, which...
Oh, yes. Yes, I'm covering that in Volume 3, as a matter of fact.
I thought you might. Yeah. Did you check it?
Only in the homage kind of section, because it really isn't a giallo per se. It's a little more, it almost feels more Antonioni in the sense of kind of refusing to give answers to the questions, but... it's an interesting film, obviously... I don't think I've seen any of his other films, if he's made any.
Well, I was about to say, like, he tends to do, like, his influences are certainly European in style, and his first movie, Cattle and Varga, is more a kind of rape revenge and a kind of 70s exploitation sort of vein. His last movie, though, I think from our conversation, is one that I think you will dig a whole hell of a lot. It's called The Duke of Burgundy.
Oh, yes.
And it's a kind of play on the Jess Franco sort of stuff, but it's a movie that really deals with eroticism without necessarily showing you any skin at all. It's incredibly fascinating. It's one of the highlights of a few years ago for myself. It's certainly one you should try and look out if you get the opportunity to. But he's another director that just, you know, it clearly wears his influences on his sleeves, and a lot of them are coming from continental Europe. Of that era, so it's quite fascinating. Troy, I just want to thank you very much for giving up some time to come and chat to myself and my listeners. I cannot wait for Volume 3 to drop, and I hope we can get you back on as and when more projects drop, that you can come back on and update us to let us know how you're getting on. But thank you very much for your time. Is there any particular social networking you want to plug? Do you have a Twitter that you want people to check out, or do you want people to follow a Facebook fan page or anything like that at all?
I shut my Twitter down because I didn't understand it. It tells you something about me. I'm only 40, but I don't know. I think I'm technologically regressive. I am on Facebook. Yes, I do have pages for So Deadly, So Perverse, for Real Depravities, and for Splintered Visions. Those pages are still up and running. I haven't really updated Splintered Visions in a long time. Obviously, this book's been out for a while, but anybody wants to go onto Facebook and search those titles, they should be able to find the pages for them at least. So Deadly, So Perverse, I update every now and again just to let people know that Volume 3 is coming, and hopefully everybody will enjoy it.
Fantastic. Thank you very much again, sir. It was a pleasure chatting to you.
Thank you.
You're listening to the podcast Under the Stairs.
And you've been listening to this very special bonus episode number 35 of the podcast Under the Stairs, where I was joined by the fantastic Troy Holworth. And that guy is just like, he's just an encyclopedia of awesome. Like that guy's knowledge, see, to pick his brains and just go over films that I know are missing from my kind of my back catalogue of knowledge, I could probably chat to him all night and just write down tons and tons of recommendations. So hopefully you guys will go out there, check his new books out as and when they drop. Specifically, if you've not checked the So Deadly So Perverse series, they are a bit pricey to get your hands on now, but get your hands on them. They're fantastic books. Must own books if you want to get into the genre known as the gialli. So yeah, and I can't wait for that new book, that volume 3 to drop. It's going to be a ton of fun getting through that and seeing how many movies I reckon are influenced by the genre and how many Troy seems to link to the genre that I haven't seen, because I know for a fact there'll be loads out there that I've never seen before that I can't wait to get into my eye sockets now. So, as we do at the end of every episode of the podcast under the stairs, I'd just like to thank you all for checking out this show. It means the world to us. We are back in a very, very short period of time, just a couple of days until we return with the Baz v Giallo, where the Baz will take on Torso, he takes on Tenebrae, and we do a kind of mini whistle-stop review of Mario Bava's Blood and Black Lace, all coming up on Monday. As always, there's a multitude of ways to check out the podcast under the stairs. If you are one of the few or one of the proud that check us out through iTunes, please hit that subscribe button. That way you always get access to our new episodes as and when they drop, and you get access to the entire back catalogue of podcasts under the stairs work. Whilst you're at that, please leave us some feedback over there. If it was 5 stars, for example, the more of them we get, the higher up the iTunes charts we're pushed for people to come across and check out the show. It means the world for us to hear back from you and get your feedback, your lovely kind words, out there on the iTunes rating system. You can also check out the show on Stitcher Smart Radio. You can check us out on SoundCloud and a multitude of other podcast apps and podcatchers. You can also visit our Facebook group page. It's facebook.com/groups/tputzcast. Goddamn best Facebook group page on the internet. Love every single one of you. You can visit our website, tputzcast.com, and check out our twin prongs of social media sexiness administered by the Baz on Instagram and Twitter. It's at tputzcast. Right, I'm going to jump out of here. We have a huge show coming. It's about 2¾ hours long. And oh my god, the Baz is on fine, fine form. It's dropping in just a few days. But until then, wherever you are, whatever the time zone is, and whatever you're up to, please take care of yourselves out there. This is Duncan McLeish broadcasting live from under the stairs. And I'm signing off. Yeah.